This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 2nd, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 297. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And a special edition of the Big Deal feature, the mid-year musings and meanderings of the MMA panel. Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program join me to look back at the second quarter of 2023 and look ahead to the third quarter. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Two down and two to go. It's halftime in 2023, which means the return of the MMA panel to make sense of it all. MMA stands for me, Mackin. Mario, as in Mario Canseco, the president of Research Co. And the A is for Andy. Andy Yan, the Duke of Data, the director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. So that's enough of David Eby singing Bon Jovi from the 2011 NDP convention. But apropos for the moment, we're halfway there. We're halfway finished with 2023 with halfway to go. Mario Canseco, has Ken Sim shown enough swagger yet? Is he working fast enough to solve the problems that he promised to do so when he ran in the election last year?
Well, it's been successful in a way, because the people who were really happy with his election continue to be really happy with the style. It's usually the same group of people, the same group of media outlets that are happy with everything that is coming out of City Hall, whether it is the other type of MMA, like we saw the other week, whether it's, you know, having more events and things like that. It was part of the reason for the supposed support of younger people to Ken Sim's party. But then again, we didn't have a significantly robust voter turnout to suggest that this is actually fantastic and magnificent. You know, we don't really have any sense of whether this actually enticed young people to come out and vote for this particular party. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag, particularly because of some of the other problems that haven't disappeared, but that have disappeared from the discussion. We don't see a lot of people tweeting early in the morning about a broken window or about finding drug paraphernalia in places. We just had an example of how terrible a campaign can be when you focus on something like this in the Langford Juan de Fuca by-election. The Liberal candidate, sorry, the BC United candidate, consistently talking about this issue and ending up in single digits. So they have to be very careful about how they look into something like this. I think there's an expectation from people that this can be solved. And in a way, this is part of what made that campaign have such gravitas. You know, put us in charge, we'll have a majority, and we'll be able to do everything that Kennedy Stewart couldn't do because he couldn't steer policy. Here we are, 8 months in, and we continue to have some of these problems, which are not going to be solved by you shaking hands with Dana White.
What has he done that has put his stamp on the city so far?
Well, I think so far it's been really able to kind of meet some of the goals of what he's campaigned on. And I think that he has met, you know, between the street sweeps on East Hastings to, you know, the Parks Board and the removal of the Stanley Parks bikeway, that, you know, they represent, I think, a certain achievement towards, you know, an extension of campaigning. But now I think the biggest challenge is governance. Is governing. That I think that it's, of course, one of the biggest challenges is that shift from the kind of visual spectacle of campaigning into the down and dirty of governance. And I think that that is going to be one of the big challenges ahead. That I think that right now we're about month number 9-ish, 9 or 10-ish of Ken Sim as mayor. And I think meeting some of his campaign promises, I think, are very much about meeting those campaign promises. But it's going to quickly now shift into that kind of space of governance. And in that space of governance, what we've seen in terms of a recent, I think, report from city staff is actually how we pay for that governance. And within that governance, we're looking at prospectively, 9% property tax increases for each of the next 4 years, through which I think is going to be one major challenge in terms of the fact that I don't think you're going to be able to pull back a lot of gains in terms of efficiencies that are going to come into some pretty tough decisions ahead for the Sim government moving forward.
Look at Surrey. Surrey still does not have the question answered of which police department will it have. Brenda Locke got elected on the promise to keep the RCMP. The NDP wants her to choose the Surrey Police Service. She's standing pat. She's even saying that she's being bullied and there's sexism at play. What do you make of this whole mess?
I think it's an easy way out for the mayor to essentially say, we're not being treated fairly by the province. We've all read how governments function in this country. Provincial government has every right to tell a municipal jurisdiction what it expects when it comes to something like policing. Surrey is not an independent city or an independent province or an independent nation. This is usually the way in which you negotiate things like this. And it seems also that it's quite complex for them to be saying that they have a mandate to do something based on 30-something thousand votes, which are actually fewer than the votes that McCallum had in 2018 to say that he had a mandate to implement the Surrey Police Service. It's a complicated issue because the government doesn't want to make it seem like it's heavy-handed in its response. They don't want to tell Surrey, this is what you're doing and that's final. You're dangling a carrot in the front of, look, we're going to take the hit for you, but you got to help us out. And the fact that she's refusing to do so is going to be very complicated for the constituents because she's also sort of telegraphed that the tax increases are going to be significantly higher unless something changes. So it's going to be a very difficult thing to go to the voters with and to even try to maintain a government when you have said no to some funds that are coming from the provincial government while at the same time saying, because I don't want to do this, I'm going to have to raise your taxes, which is really not how a center-right government should function. But Surrey has never had it's never ceased to amaze us when it comes to the way in which they try to do things. And this one is particularly perplexing, especially the tone of the press conference that she had. I don't think we've ever seen something like this from any politician, male or female, discussing any premier, male or female.
You're someone who knows how a city works. How would this be affecting everything else that goes on in Surrey?
Well, it's the fact that when it comes to policing, public safety, it tends to be the top three line items in any municipal budget, typically number one or two in a line item on a budget, and through which I think this type of uncertainty, I think, brings in, I think, some profound challenges in towards the idea of revenues and degrees, all in terms of also reputation, in terms of what is the state about the community of Surrey in terms of governance, in terms of where is the direction of the community going. And I think that it's a profound challenge, an ongoing challenge for one of the youngest and fastest growing municipalities, not only in British Columbia, but in Canada. And I think it highlights the ongoing struggles of how what used to be, say, a quieter suburb of Vancouver is a full-on city now, is a full-on urban epicenter for the province, and really how it's going to have that shift. But that being said, to and I think there is a careful dance for the province in this conversation because of the fact there are nine seats. There are nine seats that are up for grabs potentially for the province that I think can have a great effect in towards the who sits in the premier's chair. So I think that there is this careful negotiation, I think, right now, and I think that at the same time, I don't think that there are any particular easy solutions for what's going on in the challenge of policing in Surrey.
And Mario Canseco, switching gears to provincial politics, what do you think we can take away from David Eby's first full 6 months as Premier of BC? Where has he made any mistakes and where has he been successful?
I think there's a couple of things that have gone well. It's not as if the situation has broken entirely. The NDP remains popular. It's tough to follow somebody like John Horgan, who established that emotional connection with the public during the pandemic and in the later months of his leadership. He's also benefiting by what is happening with the opposition. The Greens did not do particularly well in a by-election in Vancouver Island, which is a cause for concern. We didn't have a significant level of support for BC United in either of these two seats. There's this theory that the name change hurt them, but you know, when you look at the by-elections, participation is usually for those who are very interested in politics and who actually open the door and talk to the candidates. So if they couldn't explain that they were used to be the BC Liberals and now are using a different name or a different color, that is their problem. I guess the biggest lesson coming out of this is really for the BC Conservatives. If you run a candidate who is more salt of the earth, I'm here with you, let's talk about small C conservative policies, you're going to do well. If you run somebody who has been successfully and significantly rejected by the voting population, running twice as a People's Party candidate, running once as a Libertarian candidate, and was at the bottom two when it came to school board in the last election in Vancouver, like Karen Litsky, you're not going to go anywhere. So part of what they need to do is figure out if they can run a full slate of candidates and become this challenge. Now, that being said, they're going about it the wrong way. You know, we've been exposed on Twitter to all of the commentary related to the phasing out of the letter grades in the school system. The reaction from both BC United and the BC Conservatives was exactly the same. We give the NDP an F. So if you guys are even going to do the same thing when you're campaigning against the NDP, you might as well just unite and get it over with.
Right. Andy Yan, halfway to 23, where has he succeeded and where has he failed?
Well, I think, of course, the issue of healthcare, I think, remains an ongoing kind of Gordian knot and mixed into the additional Gordian knot of housing that I think that it's a struggle to, I think, make significant strides in those areas. But then I think the issue is the fact that I think very few people feel like anyone else can make the kind of strides in these areas. So I think that there's, the announcement of the Supply Act or slow rollout of the Supply Act, I think attempts to kind of give a sense of traction. I think that, you know, proof is in the pudding, devil's in the details of really what's going to happen with the Supply Act. But then at the same time, really trying to look at alternative ideas, alternative solutions that an opposition ought to do or ought to be able to. It's actually pretty hard right now to actually see what the alternative response, credible response might look like towards what the EB government is doing. I think that they're tough files to begin with. And I think that this is important, I think, to acknowledge is that they cover some of the most complicated and most expensive elements of how we govern ourselves and a kind of collective problems that we have. But yet, I think at the same time, I think that so far the strengths have been the fact that nobody else has, I think, offered a set of credible solutions yet as of this moment through which provide a confident alternative towards how the respective current government, the EB government, is trying to offer a solution. So I think that we'll see what happens. But then, of course, you know, there are a whole bunch of current X factors. You can imagine what's happening with interest rates and really how much really finance, the role of finance is running rampant outside of the control of municipal or provincial governments and reshaping what can and can't be built in British Columbia, coupled with we're not out of this pandemic yet, and really what could happen, that they're still 5 minutes short of the end of this horror movie and anything can happen.
Finally, on the federal level, the top of the heap, the top of the pyramid, it has been in 2023, the first two quarters, halfway through the year, it's been all foreign interference all the time. June 16th, Bloom's Day, Canada reached 40 million people. And more immigrants are on the way. We had 145,000 in the first quarter. That was a record. And of course, 2025, the target is to have 500,000 a year. The questions are about how are these people all going to get adequate services, the basics, housing, hospitals, education, housing, hospitals, schools. Do we have enough? How are we going to make them have enough? How are we going to ensure that all these people have what they need to become successful Canadians? Andy?
I mean, first off, it's really nice to hear that the question for Canadians is not the question of whether we should open the door or not, whether we should have immigration or not. That I think that that's by all polls, American quickly can correct me on this, by all polls measured, Canadians in general favor immigration. Now, the question is perhaps how wide should we have that door? How many immigrants should we admit into that door? Because speaking to some of the folks I know, folks were already at 250,000 people a few years ago. We're thinking, wow, that's a significant amount of people. And then 300,000, and now at 500,000. That I think that I think it's a healthy public discussion about how wide should we keep our doors open for these new Canadians, prospectively new Canadians, because of simply this one, and simply because of how our systems have to catch up to that population. I think I've been saying that we promise these new immigrants the pursuit of the Canadian dream, but yet we are perfectly willing to expose them to the Canadian housing nightmare. And I think that this is one of the profound challenges moving forward, is actually how our other systems, the institutions through which we value as Canadians providing our quality of life, aren't necessarily given the support, aren't necessarily given the time to adapt to bring in these newcomers into our country. And I think that it is a fair question to say that it's the issue of how many immigrants should we allow in this country so that our systems can provide the support and the quality of life that all Canadians enjoy. And I think that this is one of the kind of big challenges moving ahead. But then I think moving on to the other issues you've talked about, I think that on the foreign interference question, it's really understanding that that part of the new world of migration, of people moving from around the world coming into Canada, is really the idea of the kind of transnational politics that now are brought in towards this country, and the idea that we are connected up to other parts of this world, and bringing in also the role of politics. One certainly talks about China, and I think some of the ongoing challenges in terms of the relationships to China, but I think that this is also attached towards, I think what's important to know is talking about the murder of Hardeep Singh Nijjar, and really how much of that is part of the kind of transnational politics that exists between Canada and other parts of this world, not only in China, but also India, you can imagine in Ukraine, and how much does a idea of a foreign registry is to the protection of Canadians, but more so to the protection of Canadians of these particular groups that you've seen also in the news, that it's really the subjects of this foreign interference are the elected officials of those particular groups that some have said that this foreign registry will oppress, that the idea that the foreign registry is somehow, and I mean one senator has called it the new Chinese Exclusion Act, that it has anything but that, but it's to protect the sanctity of our democracy and really the protection of Chinese Canadians and the participation of that democracy. So that, not to kind of drone on, but then really how we need to have these safeguards, these new safeguards to these new these ongoing features of our democracy in Canada.
Mario Canseco, on the foreign interference question, you've done polls on a Canadian's outlook on foreign countries, especially China. Where is the mindset of Canadians right now?
The numbers have dropped significantly for China for the past few years. The only lower countries are North Korea, Iran, and Russia, which is not a great situation to be in, of course. We don't see the same type of situation with India, for instance, but we know that there's more activity related to Indo-Canadians who live in Canada working on campaigns trying to deal with the situation in India. When we asked about foreign interference, we don't need a special rapporteur. We don't need a significant public inquiry. We need to look at what Australia did. And it's a good solution. It's an opportunity to tell people these are the folks that are working to make this country better. And we're going to make sure that we don't have any foreign agents that are going to be trying to hinder or undermine the types of activities that we want to see in our country. That should be the basis for anything that happens after this. But it was a significantly bad situation for the government to name a special rapporteur, to then say no, to have this war of memes about whether Harper appointed him governor general or whether he was a friend of Trudeau when he was younger. That's not the kind of situation that you want, and it's not something that is going to lead Canadians to be happier with what is going on. So adopting the Australian rules, if you will, would certainly work better. Well, what's important in a way is to have these policies in place, not just to look at this as a number. I was especially interested in the way Ravi Kalon, the housing minister in BC, talked about this. Like, you know, you can't just have all of these guidelines in place to bring more people in unless we have the housing for those who are already here, and if we can prepare everything for the housing of those who are quite probably going to choose to be closer to the major city centers. So that's an issue in which the two levels of government need to work together. But one that is very interesting, and the government provincially has hinted that they want to do something about this, is about the recognition of foreign credentials. For a long time, we've had doctors, nurses, people who are very keen professionals in other countries and who could bring those skills into Canada, not being able to do something like this unless they take courses, unless they do something different, unless they file or become members of a specific governing body. It's just too complicated. And this would be a way in which the government could deal with the healthcare crisis that is looming. We've never had healthcare as an issue ranked as high as we have it now. It's still lower than housing, that needs to be said. But usually healthcare in this province is around 14-15%, not 25-30%. So you have a significant number of BC residents who are looking at the healthcare system as something that isn't working very well. And we ask every year about certain institutions and features of Canada that make us proud. The drop for the healthcare system is staggering, especially after a couple of years when we've said, this is great. We all got vaccinated when we wanted. Everybody handled COVID very well. Let's be thankful that we're not the States where they had millions of people who died. This is a different type of situation. And it's not there anymore because people are experiencing the healthcare system and looking at the wait times, looking at the difficulties in getting somebody to see them, not having a family doctor anymore because they've retired or do something else. So those are the issues that can be dealt with at the same time as we deal with immigration. But it takes governments to talk to each other. And we know that that's not usually the safest thing.
Yes. I think you hit upon a really important point here, Mario, is that we talk about the Canadian institutions that we are proud about. We understand that over the last couple of years, all of these institutions have, I think, been significantly challenged. We think about really the role of the RCMP. And really now what's coming out in terms of policing, in terms of their relationships to indigenous nations, to really the ongoing challenges that that type of colonial relationship has done, and really how proud can we have as a police officer in terms of the challenges of policing, and really how does that fit in towards a national psyche? But now I think what you've touched on, and this is a really important point, is actually if we suddenly see our challenges towards the healthcare system, the Canadian supposedly universal healthcare system that is under challenge, what are the institutions we celebrate in this country? And I think that you've really hit it on the head here, Mario. Sorry, I just want to kind of point this out, because I think that this is, especially with a podcast that's coming out on Canada Day, this is one of those moments through which, you know, we had to also throw in the idea of foreign interference going into undermining or potentially undermining our liberal democracy, that I think that this is actually a fairly, I think, interesting time, precarious time, perhaps, for who we think we are as Canadians.
When you look at the policing issue, I think that's what we've found. We have roughly a quarter of Canadians who say, I've lost confidence in the leadership of the RCMP. And that affects a lot of things. You know, it's not as if you were to ask the same question in the United States about a specific police force, the numbers would be higher. But we can't just look at the Americans and say, well, you know, at least we're not having the same type of situation that they're having. This used to be the symbol. You know, you had your teddy bear dressed as a Mountie. I don't think we're selling as many as those anymore.
We'll always have poutine.
Remarkably popular, along with Hawaiian pizza. Don't forget that.
Poutine and Hawaiian invention. Pizza.
And a nod to our Vancouver Island listeners, Lucky Beer and Nanaimo Bars.
Mm. Oh, yes.
True that.
Now, the lightning round. Some predictions for the next quarter, for the next 3 months. David Eby said it again. He said it again, no election until the fall of 2024. That's on schedule. It's per the fixed election date. You know, John Horgan didn't care about the fixed election date in 2020. Do you believe David Eby? Do you really think there's going to be an election in fall 2024 on the schedule, or do you think he's going to go early? Andy?
I think on schedule, but governance from now until that scheduled election will be a campaign.
Mario?
I think it'll happen in May. I think the justification is going to be October's too cold and rainy. We don't want people knocking on doors. It was a special thing because of COVID, and it was a special situation because of a minority government, but we always vote in May. Let's vote in May. So it's still the same year, just a few months early.
And looking at American politics, Donald Trump charged in Florida, charged in New York, state charges, federal charges. He could be facing some serious time. He still plans to run for president and be on the ticket in 2024. We'll see if that actually happens. But do you think the next 3 months, will we see Donald Trump actually get arrested, handcuffed, thrown in jail overnight?
No in three, yes in six.
Mario.
Interesting. I think Andy is on the right track. No in three, yes in six. And this effectively ends his presidential race. I think this is one of the reasons why you have people like Chris Christie and all of the other people who never would run for president going, I'm going to give this a shot. I just don't see the world ready for a moment when you turn on CNN and you go, I'm Wolf Blitzer tonight. Joe Biden is in the studio and Donald Trump is joining us from the Florida State Penitentiary. I don't think you can have a debate like that. And this is why, if this happens in the next 6 months, it's ultimately DeSantis versus Biden.
The first weekend of summer was supposed to be one we're all going to be glued to our TV sets. And this was going to be the beginning of the end. The Wagner Group, the mercenary army, was on its way to Moscow, but then it wasn't. The coup fizzled out pretty quickly. So I wonder, first of all, Andy, will there be another coup in the next 3 months against Vladimir Putin?
Oh, you wonder. You wonder how this is tied in with the, you know, ongoing competitors for the Republican nomination for the U.S. For the U.S. presidency, and how perhaps these formerly or formerly strongmen are not as strong as they used to. I wonder. But I mean, you know, you wonder, and of course, you know, Slava Ukraine, that it really, I think, touches upon, I think, really some tumultuous times in Russia. I I don't know. Like, in one way, you want to believe that there is some kind of peaceful transition out, or some kind of peaceful kind of conclusion to this war. But on the other hand, you kind of wonder if he's just going to go out blazing. And if that happens, I'll be looking for some bunker designs here in East Vancouver. But that, you know, it is a bit, it's a bit kind of like worrying in terms of the stuff that you, being a teenager during the Cold War, you were kind of had your own anxieties you didn't have to worry about for about 30 years. And now you kind of get it on kind of full alert right now.
Another coup?
I think that's not going to happen. This was a fantastic opportunity for those who are looking for change. Then again, be careful what you wish for. We know that the Americans fell in love with a couple of guys named Saddam Hussein and Manuel Noriega, and that didn't end very well. So it's not going to be that simple. Ultimately, I think this ends when Vladimir Putin passes away. And there's another way to try to figure out how to settle this, somebody else who might sign those papers. I don't know if it's going to be Dmitry Medvedev necessarily, or something else, or you have some sort of council that gets together and says, okay, we may have overstepped the line here. But it's not. I don't think it'll be a coup. And I think the war is going to continue. It's not an issue that is going to be easy to solve, particularly because of the way in which the world has banded together and said this isn't something that should be allowed. Maybe not in the form of an actual war, but certainly with most of the countries letting us know very clearly that they don't stand with Russia on this one. And it's one of the reasons for Russia to be ranked as low as it is in the minds of Canadians. It used to be 5-6 years ago, you look at those numbers, and it was usually the over 55 population that ultimately despised Russia. We didn't see that with Generation X. We didn't see that with millennials. Probably those memories of Henderson's goal. Oh, yeah, let's stick it to the Soviets. Now it's everybody. And that is definitely problematic for a country that is supposed to be trying to rebuild itself and claiming territory that is not their own.
And Meryl talks about how this perhaps ends with the passing of Vladimir Putin. Do you mean of old age or something else?
No, it's tough to tell, right? I mean, people were speculating with that possibility. You know, if you got the Wagner groups going all the way to Moscow. I'm from Latin America. We know how those go. Usually when Henry Kissinger makes the calls.
Speaking of somebody who won't die, I mean, why did they take Betty White? Why did they take Betty White? I mean, Kissinger was right there. Come on.
Coronavirus, COVID-19 still with us. There's a new COVID variant on the block. It's a distant relative to XBB.1.5. Welcome to EU.1.1, EU.11. Will this become a problem? Will this amount to anything?
It's tough to tell. You know, I think the people of most of the world are done with this. And it's going to be very complicated if this gets out of hand to try to bring them back into, okay, now we have to mask again. Now we have to have a vaccine passport again. It's the kind of thing that you're going to deal with if it happens to you, even if you're very careful. But the public is right now not ready for anything that is going to change the way in which they are behaving. And this is part of the difficulty. You know, one of the reasons why this can't go away is you can't go back to the same type of guidelines that you had back in 2020 because people won't accept them. That being said, the fact that you have a lot of people communicating about how vaccines don't work. We just saw what happened with Chris Guy in Toronto, who's still wanting a recount. If we only count his votes, it's going to be fairly quick. You have Robert Kennedy running for president in the United States, almost reminiscent of Stockwell Day in the wetsuit back in 2000, trying to say that he's fine and that he never got vaccinated. It's that kind of speech that can get people riled up against this in a way that shouldn't. So I think those are the two extremes. You know, let's not do anything at all and the governments won't go for it. Or let's ignore this completely, like the Chris Geis and the Robert Kennedy Jr.s of the world are asking us to.
Mario Canseco, the other M from Research Co. and the A. Andy Yan, the Duke of Data from the City Program at Simon Fraser University, joining us for this mid-2023 version of the MMA panel.
Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Focus Taiwan, Taiwanese businessman donates dozens of emergency vehicles to Ukraine. Pai Chan Jung, head of Changhua County's Sunjian Textile Company, said he came up with the idea after hearing a friend discussing plans to help the country torn by the Russian invasion. Pai spent more than $330,000 on refurbishing 48 retired emergency vehicles, including ambulances, for donation to Ukraine. Olga Kulish, a convener of Ukrainians living in Taiwan, thanked Taiwanese. In Kyoto News, Japanese journalist who wrote about 2019 rally denied entry into Hong Kong. Yoshiaki Ogawa, 54, arrived at Hong Kong's international airport on Thursday evening, but was detained by officials and interviewed for around an hour about the purpose of his visit before being denied entry. He was sent on a return flight to Japan the next morning. The journalist told Kyoto News he intended to be in the former British colony for the 26th anniversary of Hong Kong's handover to China on Saturday, adding that he was not given a clear reason for being denied entry. In the Hong Kong Free Press, more medics left Hong Kong public hospitals last year than previous 12 months, despite recruitment drive. In the 12 months leading up to the end of April, 2,925 nurses left the public hospital system, the hospital authority announced at a press conference on Thursday. Only 2,467 were hired, leaving 458 unfilled vacancies. Meanwhile, the city is seeking to snatch overseas doctors by holding recruitment fairs in the UK and Australia.
That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland partners with Fred Meyer to increase security at stores to combat theft crimes. Todd Kemmeyer, Fred Meyer's president, said the company's Portland stores faced all-time record high levels of loss from retail theft over the past 12 months. Nike closed one of its Portland stores to public access, telling city officials the closure was due to shoplifting. Walmart also recently closed its two Portland stores for underperformance. REI was the latest major retailer to announce a plan to close its Pearl District store, and the highest profile among them to publicly blame theft as the reason. In the Seattle Times, why do Seattle area electricity rates keep rising? The typical residential electric customer's bill increased about $8.73 per month this year and will increase an additional $1.48 next year. Electricity rates in the Seattle metropolitan area increased 6.7% between April 2022 and April 2023, according to data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Stats. In April, rates were 11.4% higher than 5 years ago and 33.7% higher compared with 10 years ago. Infrastructure is the biggest source of cost for utility providers. In the Times Colonist, new Belleville Ferry Terminal a reality with $41.6 million federal commitment. The province had been waiting on a contribution from Ottawa before moving ahead with the Victoria Inner Harbour project, expected to be completed in 2027. It comes after decades of talk, studies, reports, and wishful thinking. The $304 million terminal is required to ensure the terminal will be in compliance with the Canada-US Land, Rail, Marine, and Air Transport pre-clearance agreement.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to
Canadians. Wherever in the world you're listening, whether it's here in Canada or around the world, it's Canada Day weekend up Canada Way. So this is to the Indigenous, the immigrants, and their sons and daughters, and their grandsons and granddaughters. To the young, to the old, to the abled and the disabled. The rural and the urban, the blue collar, the white collar. The hunters, the collectors, the protectors, the peacemakers, the deal makers. The workers, the investors, the lovers, and the dreamers. Happy 156th birthday, Canada and Canadians. Let's make the next 12 months better than the last 12 months.
You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of July 2nd, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 2nd of July in 2003, 20 years ago, the International Olympic Committee voted Vancouver, instead of Pyeongchang, South Korea, as the host of the 2010 Winter Olympics and Paralympics?
The International Olympic Committee has the honor of announcing that the 21st Olympic Winter Games in 2010 are awarded to the city of Vancouver.
Those games are coming back to Canada.
A turning point in the history of the city, the province, and the country, for the good, the bad, and the ugly. The metropolitan area has grown by 600,000 people over the last 20 years. So has wealth, and so has poverty. The middle class, not so much. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's PATREON.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.